Ramsey TV.
Don't look now, ladies and gentlemen, but you're about to receive the best commentary in the world on Romans chapter 11. From who? From me, your friend, the world's most outspoken Bible scholar. This is Martin Zender, of course, broadcasting from the edge of the bottom of the Florida Peninsula from my kitchen. And yeah, there's the coffee pot. But actually, I used a French press right there. It's non-mechanical. I like non-mechanical things. I used to like how the regular coffee pot, like, burbles. Does it burble? Oh, no. Oh, it gurgles. At the end of the process? Don't like that anymore. No, I don't like that. I like the quiet exactitude of the French press. And this is one of the reasons why you're going to get the best commentary in the world on Romans chapter 11, because for some reason, I am able to look at these scriptural themes not as theological problems, but as practical issues to the people of the day. For some reason, I don't know why this is a gift, I'm able to go into the living room of the Romans. This is why this kitchen is a good thing. Because I think when these big-time world-famous evangelists and expositors, I think when they get in on those big altars or those big auditoriums with thousands of people in front of them, I think they go cuckoo. I think they go a little bit crazy and they forget that what you're dealing with here in the scriptures are real people with real problems and real questions that are being answered by a real person. And now they're being explained to you by a common man in a kitchen. And this is where the letter came. The letter to the Romans came to people who were at a Bible study, the ecclesia or the church at Rome. A handful of people, maybe 20 people at any given time, maybe 11, 12. That's how it works. Somebody was in the kitchen, maybe Mary, maybe no, not that Mary. There's another Mary. There's a Mary mentioned. Just go to that Romans 16. You get all these great names. Let me see. I'm going to tell you who I think was making coffee at the meeting in Rome when this letter was read to them. There's a bunch of great names here at the end of Romans 16. My favorite part of the book. Paul greets all these people. Greet Mary who toils for you. See? Greet Mary who toils for you. What does she do? She makes coffee. One of the things she does. She greets the saints. Greet Junius, my relatives. Greet Ampliatos. No way he's making coffee. Greet Urbanus. Greet Stachys. What's Stachys doing? I don't know. He's a good guy, though, Stachys. My beloved Apelles. Greet those who are of Aristobulus. Understandable. Greet Herodian, my relative. Greet those of Narcissus. I think Narcissus would be put in charge of the coffee because Narcissus would be, you know, very careful for his or her reputation. Not sure if Narcissus is a guy or a gal to make the coffee just right. Named after probably the Greek god having to do with vanity. Now on to the scriptures. Romans 11 was written to answer a common supposition. And the common supposition was this. Well, since God has now put Israel on hold, since he has now seemingly turned away from his chosen people for thousands of years, and he just fussed over these people. He's turned away. Now we have a new message of grace, no law. A new message of God's favor. No more requirements in order to satisfy him, to please him. Now it is God coming to people with gifts. It is now God telling people to sit down. I'm going to make a wonderful presentation to you. In the Old Testament, God presented himself a different way. Yes, he presented himself as the God who tells you what you have to do. He's the one sitting down on the giant throne, and you are expected to bring him gifts, and they better be nice gifts. They better be gift wrap. They better be expensive. And they better not come with a money-back guarantee. So now God is the one bringing gifts to the nation. So your first thing you would think, and the first way you would feel, well, let's start with the first way you would feel. The first way you would feel would be, if you were a member of the nations, getting this new message, you'd be a little smug, like, heh, yep, now we're the people. God has turned away from you. You shouldn't have crucified your own Messiah. It's your own freaking fault. You had all the chances in the world. You finished. Now we're on the stage. We're numero uno. We get the good message. We get a celestial expectation instead of an earthly expectation. We don't need Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Those, your famous poster children of the promise. No. Now people like Stachys and Aristobulus and Narcissus and Junius and Mary, common Greeks, not in Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob, but or Jacob among them, common Greeks, are now getting blessings freely based on a new message of grace. So you would be pretty smug as a member of the nations, chugging down your coffee in Mary's kitchen or Narcissus's kitchen. But Paul is here to explode your little world. Paul is now going to embark on a piece of writing that will assure you that what God has done with his people? Oh, no. Don't get too smug, you Romans. Over there in Narcissus's kitchen. Don't get too smug. Yeah, things are going good for you. But if you think God has forsaken his special people that he called back there in the day, then you are sadly mistaken. And I do not want you, Paul says, to be arrogant, to be smug in your own little attitude world of I am better than Israel. Actually, you're no different. Actually, you're worse. Actually, of course, all humanity is in this cauldron of helplessness. Israel was a necessary demonstration of the inability of flesh to do the things of God. She performed her duty well. In other words, she failed miserably. Perfect. Giving God now a field to bless other people with a new message, but not at the eternal expense of the people he called back in the day. So let's begin. Romans chapter 11. Paul says, here's the opening question. I am saying then, does not God thrust away his people? There it is, a simple question. Doesn't God then thrust away his people? The way Paul asks it would be, well, obviously, yes. Does not God then thrust away his people? Well, sure, he thrusts them away. When Christ died on the cross, the veil, the big heavy curtain in the temple that kept Gentiles out of the Holy of Holies, even kept most Israelites out of the Holy of Holies. Only the high priest was allowed to go in there once a year. That veil was torn in two. That would have been one heck of a impressive thing. Of course, we know what happened. The Israel types sewed it back up and went back into business. And from that point forward, it was all artificial. It was all fake. It was all front. It was all stage play. Because God was no longer in the temple. He was going away to now inhabit the hearts of Stachys, Mary, Narcissus, Aristobulus, and the other loser Greeks from Rome and others. But this would only be a temporary move, not that God would ever take away his blessings from the nations, but that he would use the nations. Now that he's doing this great thing, he still has one eye over here. Oh, yes, he does. Just because the temple was vacated by God, he's still got one eye over here. He's going to fulfill all his promises to them, but he's going to do it in a new way. It's called the New Covenant. The New Covenant has nothing to do with us. The New Covenant has to do with God putting a heart of flesh into the nation Israel. Like they're not going to need that temple anymore. That temple is finished. They don't need that. And there are the Israel types still praying at what they think is a remnant of that temple, which is actually a remnant of the Roman barracks belonging to Pontius Pilate. It's another story altogether, but he's not done with them. So Paul answers his own question here. I am saying then, does not God thrust away his people? May it not be coming to that? It's like, that's a nice way to say, hell no. But instead of saying, hell no, Paul says, may it not be coming to that. Why do you care, Paul? This is why, still in verse 1, for I also am an Israelite out of Abraham's seed, Benjamin's tribe. Some people, listen to this, some people say that when Paul is saying this, for I also am an Israelite out of Benjamin's tribe, he's using himself as an example that God has not thrust away his people. My friends, this is impossible. How would Paul be an example of how God doesn't thrust away his people? Paul is going to prove in this chapter that no, God does not thrust away his people. He temporarily sets them aside, but he doesn't thrust them away. But if he's using himself as an example of that, like, Paul, prove to us that God doesn't thrust away his people. Paul would say, well, consider me. I'm an Israelite. I'm one of his people. Stachys could hear that. One of the dudes of the Roman Ecclesia say, but Paul, you have pretty much forsaken your Israelite heritage. You've jumped ship. You're now of a gospel that says there's neither Jew nor Greek. How would you be proof that God hasn't thrust away his people? In fact, Paul, narcissist, can you back me up on this? In fact, Paul, I would think that you would be an example that God has. You would be exhibit A, that God has thrust away his people because you're out of it and you're into something new. That would be legit, a legitimate argument. But Paul's not using himself as an example. What he's doing is he's explaining why he cares. Why he is intimately concerned and really disturbed by the very idea that God could thrust away his people. Because not only would he be thrusting away the people of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but he would be thrusting away all his promises to them. All the promises he made to Israel to bring her into a kingdom, to perfect her, to take away sin from Jacob. All these promises he made, it's like, out the door. I'm doing something new. Sorry about your luck. You might as well take all those promises I wrote down and shred them. I'm not going to do them anymore. In fact, there is a group of people today in the world who think that God fulfills his promises allegorically or spiritually in another people called spiritual Israel. They think there's a group of people here, and it's a wonder, do they ever read Romans 11? No, that's what I thought. They don't. No, they don't read it because this would dispel this crazy idea that God is, well, he's sort of fulfilling his promises to Israel, but he's doing it in another people, namely Christians. Yes, this is the theory. There's a name for this theory. Some call it replacement theology, that Christians today, you know, I always do this when I talk about Christians because they're, ooh, we're Christians, ooh, they're so light and airy with no substance. They think that now they're spiritual Israel. Spiritual Israel. Let me ask you this. It's as though Israel's not spiritual enough. A people called out by God is not spiritual enough. When they say spiritual Israel, what they mean is metaphorical Israel. They're not really Israelites, but God is transferring his literal promises to the sons of Jacob, the sons of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He's transferring the promises from them to bring them into a literal political kingdom. That was the idea. That's why the Jews were so excited when Jesus came, because they thought he was a political deliverer. They thought he was going to extricate them from the oppressive arm of Rome. That was not his intention at that time. So everybody will acknowledge that, yeah, well, Jesus came the first time. Of course, Israel back then, they wanted a political kingdom. Yeah, but now, now that God has taken his promises away, turned away from Israel to non-Israelites, to the nations, now he's going to fulfill the promises metaphorically. And it's no longer going to be a literal kingdom, but he's going to build his kingdom inside people. And there's not going to be, you think there's going to be a literal, actual political kingdom headquartered in Jerusalem? Oh, you're not very spiritual at all. No, he's fulfilling his kingdom in us. We're the new Jerusalem. We Christians are now the fulfillment of all the promises God made. Yeah, lions are lying down with the wolves are lying down with the lambs inside of us. Yeah, the new temple described by Ezekiel is inside of us. We, the arrogance of this assertion. We are the embodiment. Yeah, me, little Christian. Joe and Jill Christian, they're the embodiment of all the promises God made to Israel. It's replacement theology. It's metaphoric theology. We're now spiritual Israel. Oh, spiritual Israel. So God promising to fulfill all his intention with that natural born people, God promising to do that, that's not spiritual enough. Now, Joe and Jill Christian, they are now spiritual Israel. Joe's picking his nose. Jill's in the bathroom. They're spiritual Israel. You arrogant, cartoonish, deluded, little espresso drinking punks. No. And Paul is writing Romans 11. He doesn't know it's Romans 11 because there's no chapter headings in Paul's letters. But he is suffused with this crazy idea. Not himself, but he hears wind of it. He hears wind of it. He hears the rumblings. He detects the arrogance. Another name for this thing, replacement theology, is preterism. Preterism. I don't know what the hell the name means either. I just know that that's what it's called. It means that there's not going to be a literal kingdom. God's fulfilling everything kind of, sort of, in a metaphor way with Joe and Jill Christian. Don't worry about it. There is no literal kingdom. The kingdom is within you. That is a scriptural quote, but they misapply it. They misapply it. Oh, there's a political entity inside of me? Where is it? Next to my liver? Behind my breastbone, also known as the sternum? Is it in the pelvic area? Where is the kingdom located exactly? Between my heart and my lungs? Paul gets wind of it. It's the logical. It's actually a reasonable thought. That God must be done with his people. Didn't that veil get rent in half? Didn't it get ripped? Okay, well, obviously God's done with his people. He's like giving up on them. Thanks for the example, Israel. Thanks for being the perfect example of how flesh and blood is not able to do the dictates of God. Thanks for being the example that no one is righteous, no, not one. We heard that verse mentioned, but we didn't actually see it enacted in a people. But you have, in a most convincing way, shown the human race that human beings are totally freaking terrible at doing what God wants. Now that we know that, we of the nations can relax and we can revel in the grace and thank God, and we don't have to kill our little sheep anymore. We don't have to kill any sheep anymore. Great, huh? Love to let the sheep slip. Paul hears a rumbling. He's not having it. He can't stand it. And so he launches on this most beautiful chapter of Scripture. And I love this chapter. I've studied it for 30 years from the practicality of people in their kitchens hearing this letter for the first time. I get it. I've gotten it for a long time. It's a gift. I don't know that I can still see these supposedly theological words in a practical way. And I am really anticipating, I can't wait, after this introduction, to bring this marvel of exposition by our apostle to you.